welcome to Hurt Less, Live More, a show for honest and sometimes raw conversations about the hurts that we suffer in life and how we get ourselves past them. And we welcome guests from all over the world. I'm JJ, the practical alchemist, and as ever, psychiatrist and coach Dr. Mark Goulston is with me here. And today, our guest is a man who knows all about getting past life's hurts. It's Doug Dane, author of Mistaken Identity, a book that shares the many lessons that he's learned over the years, lessons that have enabled him to thrive. And it's great to have you with us, Doug. Thanks for joining us. Mark, we had a chat before we came in to record this.
Well, for a guy who wrote a book called Just Listen, I just didn't shut up. I just kept going on. And what I was talking about, and I hadn't met Doug before, is that that I believe, yes, you don't want to just get past the pain of your life. You want to get over it. And I'll share this with you, Doug. And Doug was very complimentary to me. So it looks like we're going to have a conversations beyond this. One of my other books was PTSD for Dummies. And I've actually been trying to rename the diagnosis, but I gave up on that. And I've been trying to rename it as re-traumatization avoidance, RTA, because when I've talked to people who have been very traumatized by their pain, you know, by being abused, molested, all kinds of things, being in war, when you look them in the eye, and when I've looked them in the eye and I said, good for you, you're so courageous, you got over it. They look at me like deers in the headlights and they say, I never got over it. I say, what do you mean? They said, I got past it, but I'm not the same. What do you mean you're not the same? I'm tentative. I'm not comfortable. I'm always checking things out to see what danger there might be there. And I don't really know joy. I have fun, but I don't really know joy because I'm not relaxed. I don't know peace. I know exhaustion. And then when I ask them, and this is the re-traumatization avoidance, I say, well, do you think you could ever go through it again? And they'll look at me like deers in the headlights and they'll say, no way. I don't know why it didn't take me down the first time. And so that has sort of oriented my approach to things. And one of the reasons JJ and I started this is because we believe that the world, and there's nothing wrong with coping. It's a distant second to healing. But we believe that the world runs away from hurt and fear very quickly into coping mechanisms that distract them from it, but often doesn't help them. Drinking, eating, anger, you know, road rage. And so we believe that if people can just feel the hurt, feel the fear, and share it with someone who doesn't rush in with them to distract them from that. My experience is people start to cry with feeling less alone in it. And the crying is like pus draining from the core of the dark night of the soul. So I'm going to shut up because I wrote a book on just listening. So anyway... can you relate to any of that, either of you, or should I put a sock in my mouth and behave myself?
Well, I was going to say, Doug, you probably know all about everything that Mark's just been talking about. And maybe you can just share a wee bit about what your life experience has been as well.
Yeah, they call them, the CDC in the US calls it adverse childhood experiences. 60% of adults have suffered at least one of those, which is physical, emotional, sexual abuse, mistreatment, neglect, witnessing violence would be descriptions of that. And so I suffered pretty much all of them. that you can consider. I was given up as an infant, a baby, when I was born to foster care. My mom gave me up for adoption. 6 months later, I got adopted into a very violent alcoholic home. Both of them were violent alcoholics in a poor family. They both, those adults, my adoptive parents, both came from violent alcoholic families. And so I got dropped into this home. And of course, had to endure that and survive that. And that lasted till I was about 13 years old when I threw my mom out of the house. Literally, I picked her up and I carried her outside, called the police. And then I drifted looking for, you know, they say looking for love in all wrong places. And so I was drifting around the streets, literally trying to find, you know, love, validation, approval, direction, guidance, just trying to find, feeling good about myself. And I ended up in a ring of pedophiles for 2 years. It was four men that had traded at least 23 boys that were uncovered through the investigation. So I suffered the hands of these pedophiles, sexual abuse for 2 years. That ended my kidnapping when I was 15. And I arrived back home from that. Police arrived at the door. These detectives armed with, you know, photos and threats. I'm trying to, you know, find other boys. I think their intentions were good, of course. And then I was left alone to try to figure that out as well. And then turn to drugs and alcohol and just try to cope, as Mark described, which was fairly common. Again, still searching for some validation through relationships of some sort. Turned to drugs, and that was a way to get friends. So I was very popular because I had drugs. I had a job. I had money. I had drugs. I could afford drugs, rather. Anyway, growing up in a poor family, I didn't want to live poor. So I got into business thinking I was going to make $1 million. And by 23, I'd gone bankrupt within about 6 months, landed back on my feet, got into another business, and then learned something at 24 years old I never knew about. And it was an introduction to a concept, an idea that I actually had conscious control over my thinking and my unconscious. And then I went into business and I started to succeed. And then my second marriage failed at age 39. And I wrecked it like I did all my relationships because of my story. But the story I just told you was all blocked out. That came out through the beauty and unconditional positive regard of a wonderful mentor counselor who saw there must be a story. So I went on an investigation, met neighbors, friends, family, teachers, social workers, police detectives, et cetera. And this whole story came out and I went public with it in the newspaper and on television in 2001. And then people kept coming to me and going, how did you do it? Because I really let it go. I really let go of the pain. I let go of any negative feelings towards my parents, my abusers. I really, really began to let it go. And but I couldn't tell you what I did. I mean, I knew what I did, but I couldn't tell you how I did it. And so that sent me on a new pursuit to try to understand, because everybody I was meeting was suffering and struggling. And like statistically, I said 60% earlier, and that's sort of the story. And so that's where I've been on a path since 2001 to try to figure it out. And I did. And I realized it took me way too long. I made it way too hard. And it was very, very simple, but I made it complicated. And it was through another mentor of mine that undid all my belief systems around how I should operate to let go of the past. And he kept saying, Doug, it's so simple. It's so misunderstood. And of course, I was going down the traditional narrative and path that our culture and society has been going down since, you know, the 50s, really, this sort of path of the current narrative around psychology and mental health. And I went down that road too. There was some roads along that major road or journey that were helpful, but I got lost a lot. And anyway, I found my way, and now I'm trying to get that in the hands of other people, because life is short. And, you know, we're just, too many people are struggling in life, and I think it's wrong.
Can I suggest what might have happened for you? Because I tend to, can I just share what you just triggered in me?
Yeah, of course. Whatever you like.
I'm thinking that the more you just shared your unvarnished pain, the more you attracted other people who connected to you with theirs.
Yeah.
And the more they connected with you in your sharing the pain and the failure and the shame, the more it freed you, because other people were coming to you.
Yeah.
Because you were freeing them. There was something about they could relate to you.
Yeah.
And the fact that they could relate to you maybe helped you feel less emotionally alone. And that maybe there was even a purpose to all this pain, because people were just coming out of the woodwork to say, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Yeah.
And what did I do other than just expose my pain? And that was it. So is any of that accurate?
That's exactly what it is. In the book, I say talking works. And what it does is it doesn't normalize what happened to you. It normalizes you. And so, I didn't grow up with religion, or I'm not Christian, but I kept hearing the truth shall make you free. And so that's what motivated me to tell the story. I thought, because my counselor said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to tell the story. I gotta go public with it to normalize and minimize my negative perceptions towards myself, not minimize what I went through, because to me, people do that. We have to attach and lay blame in the right spot and place the monkey on the right person's back. But that's exactly what it was, Mark. And like you, when we were talking earlier, is that, you know, your approach with people you work with, I just became, I call myself an earnest investigator. I'm really earnest about investigating, understanding, you know, what happened to you and how do you feel about yourself, and you know, why do you feel that way and why do you see yourself that way? And so I just became a really empathetic listener, because that's what somebody did for me. And I was watching people that were helping me, what they were doing and what worked for me. And then I sort of emulate those characteristics. But that, you're bang on, that's exactly it. And you know, the whole purpose of the part of the purpose of the book is to get people to not be afraid to tell their story, because everybody wants to tell their story. Everybody, but they're afraid to.
And that's maybe because it's too hurtful, it's too painful to tell their story.
Well, they perceive that to be true. Yeah.
Yeah, I can resonate with that. Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. And then just getting back to your book, very simply, why mistaken identity? Why did you call it that?
Well, I was adopted. And what I discovered through in the last 8 years, really most of my work has been in the space of really understanding how our mind works. And I didn't know this, that my mind directs my brain and my nervous system. Well, I didn't like the way I was thinking. I didn't like the way I was feeling, physically or emotionally. And so when I was introduced the concept that I have, there's a widely accepted fallacy that conscious rational thinking can take control over the unconscious. Well, I didn't think I could do that, but you can, and I learned how to do that. And so as I was learning this, the other thing I did not know about our mind is that it's directed, our mind is a machine, it's a cybernetic machine, it's directed by the self-image. My image of myself, my opinion of myself, how I see myself, the sort of person I think I am, dictates, controls my mind, which controls my brain and nervous system. So it's no wonder I was dealing with anxiety and depression and thoughts of suicide and, you know, anxiety, just self-loathing and shame and all the stuff that came from the story, right? And so as I was talking to people, I'm going, maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm the only one that has this poor opinion of myself. And as time went on, I've talked to thousands of people in my work, and I go, no, everybody has a self-image problem, meaning the image or the concept they have of themselves is distorted. It's off track. It's inherited. It was beaten into them, whatever the case may be. And I'm just thinking one day, and I go, it's like I feel like I'm in an emotional prison. And it's a case of mistaken identity. I they got the wrong guy. And the real villain is my upbringing and my conditioning And now it's the current system that's keeping me stuck in jail. And so it just came out of me literally. And I just think people are mistaken about their identity, how they see themselves, because they were, when they were raised, when you first arrived here, when you could start to interact with the adults, they started programming you. At first you started imitating them, you know, watching how they move, eat what they eat, drink what they drink, speak the way they speak. And then they started drilling the rules into you. And they started, you know, dropping in their biases and their values and their beliefs. And of course you just, you inherit it, you take it on. Okay. Mom and dad say so. And then you started to get punished if you didn't get it right. And you were seeking praise if you did get it right. So if you weren't following the rules, you got in trouble. You got punished. In my case, I got hit. Then you were judged. And so you watch the adults. They're judging each other. They're judging themselves. They're judging each other. They're judging their friends, their family. Then they start judging you because you're not getting it right. And so then you learn to judge yourself. So very early on, we feel off track. We just, what's wrong with me? And the parents, one of my chapters in my book, Mom and me used to always say, what the hell's wrong with you, Dougie Dane? What's wrong with you? What a terrible question to ask a little boy. Terrible question.
I tell you what, though, it's a question that many of us have been asked over the years.
Yeah,
And well, just on that point, we're going to go for a break now, but I know Mark will want to come back with a few thoughts on that. But if you can hold that thought for now, we're going to have a short break to hear from our station sponsors. Back after this.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Hurt Less, Live More here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station, with me, JJ, Dr. Mark Goulston, and our guest today, Doug Dane. And Mark, I think that you probably want to come back on some of the things that Doug was talking about before the break.
Yeah, here's an exercise, Doug, that you might like, and I offer it to you, and if you like it, use it freely. And the exercise is I'll ask people, I'd like you to imagine that your personality is a circle. And in the circle are the parts of you that are trying to prove, show, hide, or please. Prove, show, hide, or please. Mm-hmm. And now I'd like you to imagine just eliminating all of them, what's left. And a lot of people will say nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, all I am is proving, showing, hiding, or pleasing, which means you don't own you.
That's right.
You're leased out to the world. And if you can just do the exercise, do it while you're taking a long walk. If you're lucky, you may discover a calling that's been calling out to you for decades, but it kept getting a busy signal.
Right. Mm-hmm. Love that.
And I'll tell you something that I am doing because my kids, my grown kids, they've done fine. They've done more than fine. But I think I screwed up a little bit. So I get to see my grandchildren every day. There are four of them, four and under. And when I'm with my grandchildren, I bathe them in utter delight. You know, I'm mostly ignored by my family because, you know, I mean, they're involved with the details and my wife is up on the details. But I don't want to be this moody grandpa, or like my dad was a little bit moody. And so I do my best to race home when they're going to be over visiting. And I am mainly ignored, but every now and then my grandchildren will look up at me and I want them to see in my eyes utter delight. They don't have to prove, show, hide. They don't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can reach all of us can reach into our souls, because what happens is they take a second look It's like a second scoop of ice cream of unconditional love. And I mean, literally, they'll look and then they'll take another look because they're not getting that from the world.
Right.
My children and my son-in-laws love them, but you know, it's very operational. When my kids were young, their nickname for me was "Hi Kids, Bye Kids, Love You Kids." We laughed about it, but it wasn't funny.
No, I hear you.
It is kind of funny though, but and I wasn't close to my grandparents because they were at a distance, but I'm just sharing that for the benefit of our listeners and the three of us, because I want them to have this core of belief that they are. I'm using this quote from Mr. Rogers. I watched a recent documentary, and he said, "We have the power to love people into being."
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I'm doing. I'm doing my best to love them into being. And I think it's good for them. I know it's good for me. But so can either of you relate to, you know, whatever I'm saying?
Yeah, I certainly can. I mean, I suspect that, Doug, that was something that was severely lacking when you were growing up. And it's not necessarily anything that I recall either. Only because I think it's quite uncommon for people to be so consciously sort of glowing and flowing with that emotion of love and unconditional love. So I think it's quite unusual, but I tell you what, if I had been experiencing that when I was growing up, I would have been a different person. Absolutely. It would have changed my life, I think.
In what way?
I would have been more confident. I would have been less, as Doug's talking about, looking for me, and you were talking about as well, you know, who is the me, which is the bit that is actually me. I think I would have been far more comfortable in my skin had that been something that I experienced when I was growing up, rather than always feeling that you were a bit of a problem, maybe. And, you know, always a bit scared that you're going to do something wrong, or you weren't quite achieving what you were supposed to be achieving. Yeah. Always that anxiety.
What about for you, Doug? Could you?
Yeah. Well, my first thought, that's a beautiful, it's not a story. It's the way you're living. That approach that you're taking should not be limited to our children or grandchildren.
Mm, yeah.
It's actually, I feel, Mark, that's operating within your nature. We don't operate within our nature. Mm-hmm. You know, it's unnatural for us to judge. It's unnatural for children to be mistreated. That's all unnatural. If we want to live with joy and happiness and peace, we have to operate within the confines of nature. And so we've been taught to do a lot of things that just aren't natural, you know? And and so these young people, they're just, when you arrive here, you're just looking to find your way and figure out who you are and why you're here. That's in your nature. But then you get programmed and conditioned and directed and criticized and punished and praised, and you get confused easily. And they look at you with this confused look, you know? And I love what you said, this idea of, you know, just love them into being, because I think, you know, so for me, I was a young person that really struggled. I grew into an adult that struggled, and then I was going to become a father. I thought, all right, I got to break this cycle. When the story came out, people were coming to me and, you know, everybody wanted to elect me, you know, a leader and activist to end child abuse. And everybody would ask me, but I said, no, you know what? I think I'm going to breed it out. And they go, what do you mean? I said, well, as a father, if I can rid myself of my past and my pain and my shame and guilt, get rid of all that, and not repeat the same mistakes to my daughter, and then if I can raise her to be healthier and happier, then she can raise her children, and maybe within a couple of generations, we can, you know, reduce it or breed it out. And that was sort of the idea behind it. And I made my mind up that my job is to figure out who this little person is and help her become that person without judgment. You know, I really had to work hard to not drop my rules, values, and beliefs upon her, which took some work in the beginning. So I just love that. I think it's such a, when I wrote the book originally, it's interesting because the first chapter is called Stop Judging. And when the pandemic hit, I said, the real pandemic is judgment. That's our biggest problem in the world. You know, if we could just eliminate judgment, we'd let go of the past. We'd let go of the past in our culture, let go of the past in our religion, let go of the past in certain parts of the world are still fighting. Like, it's all judgment, baby. And we're judging ourselves and we judge other people through our own perception and our lens. And it just isn't natural. That's why we don't feel good about ourselves. You'll feel a lot better if you can just be yourself and act naturally, which is just love and kindness, you know, and just some simple rules to living life joyfully. But most of us don't know what the rules are. And a lot of us don't want to follow them.
And I love what you're saying about living naturally. It is the natural order that we should just be joyous. Yeah. And yet, as Mark says, so few of us actually know what joy is, which is it's a criminal offense against humanity. I think that we're being driven into these states of despair. And of course, I shared with you both earlier that I had some statistics come through that showed that in the UK, 8 in 10 teenagers claim to suffer from mental health symptoms. And 1 in 3 need professional support for depression or anxiety. That's twice the adult rate. And, you know, Mark, you're a suicide expert, and I know that you do a lot of work to try to reduce those numbers of teen suicides. But what are we doing to young people that this is how they're turning out? This is what they're experiencing. Surely we're not bathing them in unconditional love.
I wrote an article. I think it's available on my website, and it's called How You Became You. And then the subtitle is Doing a You-Over. And what I talked about is that the way our personality forms is that whenever we get hurt from the outside world, or something doesn't go right, or when we hit a home run or score a goal, we're always looking back to our parents. It's called rapprochement. And we internalize what we see from them. And there's 4 different things we can see from them. In some of the wealthier communities in America, we can be coddled. You know, we can be bailed out. So, and which doesn't prepare us for the world. So we can be coddled, criticized, or neglected. And when you internalize those things, when you're coddled, you know, you expect always to be bailed out. And then when you get older and you're not bailed out, you turn to drugs because, you know, drugs will bail you out of a bad mood. When you're criticized, you internalize, your hurt turns into anger. And I'm going to get even with the world. And when you're neglected, you're just fearful. I'm not going to take any chances because if I fall on my face, I'm just all alone. And one of the things we receive too little of is what I call loving teacher, mentor, coach. So I had 8 mentors. They've all died. And I'm a mentor to about 45 people because... And in all those relationships, I was taught, I was mentored, I was coached in a loving way. And I think all my mentors, it wasn't just about what project are you working on? Yeah, they were curious about that. But I think what happened is they loved me. and I love them. And in fact, I have something called the Dead Mentor Society, because all my mentors have died. The last one was Larry King from CNN. Went to breakfast with him every day before the pandemic for a couple of years. And then before him, there was a big leadership guy, Warren Bennis. And so what happens is whenever I mess up, I'll beat up on myself and I'll call upon one of my dead mentors to walk me through it. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is they do walk me through it, and I have this incredible feeling of appreciation and missing them. And when I can lean into appreciating them and missing them, you know, I suddenly stop beating up on myself. So I don't know if you're following this, but I'm a great believer and practicer of being a mentor. I love being mentored and I love mentoring. Because absolutely. I think it's a way of making up for what all of us didn't get that would have changed our lives, JJ.
No, absolutely. I agree with you. And I've benefited from mentors as well. As Doug's also said, you know, they were incredibly important. And I know that Doug's had some great mentors in his life. But let's just come back to that in a moment. It's time, I think, to take another very short break. We'll be back right after this. More news from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Hurt Less, Live More with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and Dr. Mark Goulston, plus our special guest today, Doug Dane. And Doug, before the break, Mark was talking. Did any of that land with you? Were you resonating with any of that?
Well, you started talking about these worsening stats among young people, and Mark was talking about mentors. I love working with young people because they're not as locked in, you know, for as much time as adults are into the way they operate, the way they think and what they believe. But the problem is young people don't really have great mentors. This is not a mentor, folks. Mm-hmm. Okay.
You're holding up a mobile phone or a cell phone.
A mobile phone. Yeah. These smartphones aren't that smart. Yeah. And, so I have a few comments. We got to get this straight. The numbers for mental health are not going to turn around, okay? Unless we create a new model that makes the existing model obsolete, right? Statistically, it's getting worse and getting worse and getting worse because people don't really understand the real cause of mental health problems. Secondly, I love working with young people, but they don't know what the hell they're talking about because the adults don't know what the hell they're talking about. And they're raising these young people. Okay. And the young people, you know what they're doing? And it starts very young age. They're going, something's off track with the adults or with the parents, or the teachers. They don't know what the right track is yet, but something's off track. And so what do? They turn their orientation away from the parents and the teachers. And it used to be a real strong dominant force, which still is, called peer orientation. In the absence of a mother goose, baby goslings will follow anything. And so we got to keep our kids in relationship with us, not with this phone. Okay. And the answer does not lie within here. And so there's a popular mental health narrative, like here in Canada, in North America, probably all over the world, there's a real strong narrative on mental health. Mental health awareness, and let's talk about it. But it's great to talk about it, but if you just keep talking about it, it's created a paradigm in itself. Kids are self-diagnosing, you know, they got all the answers because they go on here and they think this has all the answers. And I think we got to do, in my book, the work I've been trying to do is get people to understand what very few people actually do understand, and that is how to think. Like I said earlier, very few people understand that you have conscious control over your mind. That's what's directing your brain and nervous system. And if you're having mental health problems, anxiety, depression, it's because your mind is creating your own problems for the most part. I've let go of everything from my story. I think I see my story as a gift. I saved a little boy's life, you know, by being in that home. I could have landed in any home. I landed in that home. There could have been another little boy that wouldn't be able to survive like I did. I see my story as a gift. I just changed my perception and my judgment to what I've been through. So I'm trying to do a few things. Number one is show people and get them to understand that, listen, whatever happened to you didn't happen because of you. It simply happened to you. It wasn't about you. Okay. Secondly, there is fallout, trauma, all kinds of mental health problems, physical problems that come from those adverse childhood experiences, but you don't have to live your life that way. There's another narrative that goes along with the whole mental health narrative, and that's this victim mentality. It's very convenient to be a victim, very convenient. And sometimes victims turn into villains, you know? And so that's going on. So I'm trying to get people to change their mind about their past and their story. Because if you keep looking at the past and dwelling on the past, that's where you're going to stay. And that's where I was stuck for a long, long time. And we do have to take control of our thinking and our mind. I truly believe most people are suffering with mental health issues, anxiety, depression, at least those things. It's within their control to change it. Now, that's a fairly, you know, generalized statement of somebody that's got anxiety and depression. Listen, they go, you don't understand what you're talking about. And I said, well, I do understand, because I was in the same boat a lot of people are in, because I suffered from anxiety and depression until I finally woke up and I go, oh, and I was taught to think properly and take control of my thinking. And then, you know, we just got to start approaching life differently. And we got to understand like what these things are doing and what social media is doing and all those things. And we live in what's called hypnotic rhythm. You know, we're hypnotized and we just follow a rhythm. We get up and we go off to work and we hop on our phone. We do these things. We got to wake people up. I'm in the business of waking people up and trying to change their mind to change the course of their life, because you don't have to live as a victim. You don't have to suffer as you were suffering. You can certainly suffer a heck of a lot less. And you can live a life filled with joy. Life is not hard, okay? Life is actually very simple. We make it hard. Now, life's not easy. It's filled with problems, but it's your perspective on how you deal with those problems that makes it hard or makes it easy. And I just believe that we can take control of that. And I was always a guy that wanted to walk the talk. You know, when I came out of that counselor's office and I went public with my story, people asked me to start speaking about it. She challenged me, said, Doug, you have no right to stand up in front of an audience or come on a podcast and tell people what they should do or what they shouldn't do unless you're walking the talk. And I was always that guy in business. I wanted to prove I could do it. And I want to teach other people to do it. And so I'm living proof. And I met lots of other people like me that you can let go of your past and you can move forward and you can live life in joy. And there's only two ingredients to living life in joy. And we're born with it: integrity and love. Mm-hmm. We're out of integrity because we're following rules that just don't work. And we're afraid to love because we're afraid to be judged. And if you work on those two things, man, oh man, life can get a hell of a lot easier. I think just too many people are struggling. They shouldn't have to.
Yeah, it comes back to being true to your nature, doesn't it? Being natural. Yeah. And you're holding up your mobile phone as you were talking there. And just a note on this new research, it's actually come from an AI chat mental health app, Wyza. I don't know if I've pronounced that right, WYSA. Now, it also says that an astonishing 78% of the kids that they surveyed would prefer to speak to an app rather than their teachers. And, you know, that struck me is really quite drastic.
Well, I think part of it is whether we consciously or unconsciously think it, I think our experience of people is that they're always biased. I mean, you're speaking to biases, and those biases feel kind of controlling and limiting. Whereas I think with AI, and it's getting even better, there's a feeling that, well, I'm getting a response based on what I put into it. Now, AI also has biases, but it's getting better and better. And I think that's the sad thing about it is it can cause us to not turn to human beings because you can get a certain warmth from, like, my grandchildren are getting a lot of warmth from me in my utter delight, as opposed to just a non-judgmental answer. And Doug, I want to offer a suggestion if I can, because you're doing a lot in the world. I'm very sensitive to language, and I'm a great proponent of what I call experience near language versus experience distant language. Experience near language, the other person can feel it at the same time they understand it. Experience distant, they have to think about it because it can be abstract. Mm-hmm. And given the fact that a lot of the people in the world can't stand to think, they just don't like the word think. Just a suggestion that you might use the words, you may not be aware, but you can actually, when something happens to you, you can choose what you believe.
Right. I like that.
And choosing and believing are more visceral than you can change the way you think. You're essentially saying the same thing.
Yeah, I like that.
But if you say, you may not think you can do that, but you can stop for a moment. And what is it that you believe right now? Blah, 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 blah. I can understand that.
Yeah.
I can understand that. But did you know that you can choose what you believe right now? Really? I didn't know that. So it's just a tweak.
I love it.
But I thought it might be helpful.
Yeah, it is very helpful.
Helps me as well, Mark, because I've been talking with somebody who's struggling right now, and that's a lovely form of words I will use. Yeah, thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, I needed it because when I was working with suicidal patients, as soon as I used clinical language, I'd look in their eyes and they would check out and they'd say, "You're not getting it."
Yeah.
Because to them, I was classifying them to keep at arm's length from them. So I had to abandon that language because I could see in their eyes that I was being clinical, but they experienced as my saying to them, "I wouldn't touch your pain with a 10-foot pole. But we will call it this. And this is the DSM, and you might even be able to get insurance payment for that. But we may have to check on that because if you don't, I'm not sure that I can see you." So I just abandoned that. So, and I'm trying to introduce to the world that, are you using language out of your own anxiety that I've got to prove to the world that I know what I'm talking about?
Right.
And that's a very human thing, but it can have the net effect of having people in your vast audiences, Doug, of smiling because you have that motivational energy, but they will then do nothing.
Mm-hmm. I wish I had all the answers. So I always take great advice. It's good advice. I love it.
Yeah. Well, no way. You have a greater reach, at this stage of your life than I do in my life. So I keep doing what you're doing. You're saving lives.
And I appreciate it. Just real quick, what you said about the language and what JJ, you said about the app and AI and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Mark, your description of that circle, and then just how you're treating, the utter delight with your grandchildren. The very thing that the young people are seeking to get is they're not going to get it from the AI. What they're doing is they're disconnecting further away. 78% would rather talk to this thing than their parents. And that's really ultimately where we got to get them back to. The parents got to get their act together and work on their stuff and grow up. And we got to get our children in relationship with us, because this AI is not going to solve the problem. It is going to, the good news for them is that maybe it'll be a way to express some of the things that are on their heart and mind. And I believe in expression, talking works, get that out. That I think will help. I think it's a band-aid. I don't think ultimately is going to be the cure per se, but they're not going to get the very thing they're searching for, which is outside that circle you talked about and that utter delight. They just want to feel good about themselves. They want to know they're okay. They want to know they're loved and validated. They want to know they're on the right track. And you don't get that. You don't get that from a phone. You don't get that from AI. And that's just back to what I said. We got to, like, the people that are behind these things.
Your mobile phones. Yeah.
They're driving. Sorry. Yeah. We're on audio here.
Okay.
The people behind these smartphones, they are driving and controlling and directing human behavior. And a lot of it is motivated, you know, I'm not going to get into that, but people motivated by profit and stuff. It ain't going to work, folks. Okay. And maybe it's the next best thing, but it's not going to solve the problem that we're facing. That mental health problems are on the rise, suicides on the rise, funding requirements are on the rise. We need a better model, and AI ain't the answer.
One of the problems I have is that the world's increasingly becoming addicted to excitement over intimacy.
Mm, yeah.
And adrenaline is, you know, the adrenaline rush of excitement is a very hungry monster, and it needs to be constantly fed. And you can make a lot of money off of video games and that sort of stuff. And intimacy, closeness, seems to take too long. You know, pausing to actually notice that someone you care about isn't doing well and just stopping your agenda and saying, something's eating away at you. What is that? No, it's okay. No, it's not okay.
Right.
What is it? And as you begin to talk and they bring it out of them, and by the way, if you get people to talk, don't suddenly jump in and reassure them, oh, it'll be okay. Mm-hmm. Because they're then going to think, why the heck did I even open up to you? If you're fortunate and they open up to you, they'll start to cry with relief because they're just stuck inside. Yeah. And don't be afraid when they cry because you're actually giving them relief.
You know, the good news in all this is it's in our nature as humans. We will continuously pursue that feeling that we're pursuing. And at some point, unfortunately, some people will get sick, some people will die, some people will get hurt, but ultimately people will find, I truly believe, most people at some point will find their way. It generally takes a large emotional impact to disrupt your unconscious thinking. But as humans, we want that feeling of joy. And so you'll turn to the different things that we turn to in today's society, but ultimately it won't satisfy you. That yearning will still be there. And hopefully one day you wake up and you go down the road less traveled, and you find your way where you can live whatever's left of your life in a joyful way. And so you feel better and you do better and help other people do better, you know.
Well, and on that note, let's hope that this conversation, which I've thoroughly enjoyed, by the way, will help other people find their way in that way. Doug, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been great to have you on the show. Mark, no time for a final word from you. I'm sorry, but I think, you know, as ever, we've had some great insights from you, from both of you today. So thank you so much once again. And if you're listening to this on a podcast, do like and share and do all those fabulous things that will help us and maybe help somebody else as well. But for now, I hope you'll join us another time. Goodbye for now.